Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On February 6, 2006, people began lining up and down the street outside Atlanta's Ebenezer Baptist Church to pay their respects to the late Coretta Scott King, widow of course, the civil rights leader, the Reverend Martin Luther King. The spectacle inspired playwright, novelist, essayist, and poet Pearl Clegg to imagine the personal stories of five fictional women of different ages, different backgrounds, different points of view, and show how Coretta Scott King's death had brought them together near the end of the long line that day. A Song for Coretta is Ohio State Theater's debut in Kappa's newly restored Lincoln Theater, so we invited Pearl Clegg to join us today to talk about her work. A bit later, we'll bring in the director, Leslie Ferris, and also the assistant director and choreographer, Mopi Matabedi, and see what they have to say about the play. It opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Theater. Welcome to the show, Pearl.
Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Why a musical reference for the title, A Song for Coretta?
Well, music was a big part of Coretta King's life. She actually studied music as a college student. She did concerts as a solo performer, and music was a big part of her life. There's a wonderful photograph of her getting ready for a concert in a wonderful white formal gown and all of that. But I think that people forget that music was such a big part of her life because the movement became her all-consuming passion, and certainly the kind of music that she was singing then became more grounded in that movement or in the church, so that she became more the pastor's wife who would sing the solo on Sunday morning rather than a person who had been headed for a concert career.
You were inspired to write this play from watching the lines form on television.
Absolutely. I turned on the 11 o'clock news to see, you know, just the regular news of the day, and they, of course, led with news of, you know, the arrangements for Mrs. King's funeral and the fact that she was currently lying at Ebenezer Baptist Church, and that people who wanted to come pay their respects could do that. And they had a reporter standing outside of the church, and it was a terrible night, just bad weather and cold and the kind of weather we usually don't have in Atlanta. But people were wrapped around the block just waiting patiently in all that bad weather to pay their respects to Mrs. King. And they had umbrellas and they were kind of huddled together, but it was a very well-behaved, comradely kind of crowd. And I found myself wondering who would be standing in that line for hours in the cold rain at midnight to pay their respects to Mrs. King. And that's really where the play came from, just trying to imagine five very different women who might have come there for very different reasons to pay homage to someone they admired.
When you get an idea like that, do you immediately start writing?
I do. I do, especially one like that, because that was an idea that came all at one time, all of one piece. And it was such a visual thing. I tend to be a writer who deals more in hearing the language, hearing the dialogue, and the visual part comes later. But this was such a strikingly visual piece that I just, you know, it kind of came to me very quickly, and I wrote it very quickly.
And the sound is important, too. Now, obviously, there is a little bit of a score to it, but the thunder and lightning, or I say lightning, I didn't see any lightning in this particular production, but I imagined it when I heard the thunder.
There you go, and that's what we need from our audience.
I'm very imaginary. So, but the thunder, is that something that you wrote into it?
Well, that actually was part of the, you know, was part of the evening, so that it definitely says that the, you know, in the script that they're standing out here in the middle of a rainstorm. That's why they offer each other umbrellas at various times. You know, the ones who have umbrellas try to kind of huddle with the ones who don't, because the rain and the weather was very much a part of what intrigued me about that moment. I think that many people think of Coretta King as primarily Dr. Martin Luther King's widow, but he died when she was very, very young, and she spent the rest of her life as a real powerful moral force in all kinds of progressive movements. She was definitely a person who, you know, looked out for her husband's legacy, but she also was very involved in fighting for peace and fighting against homophobia and all kinds of causes as a very bright, independent woman. So that I kind of wanted the characters to be responding to different parts of her so that we can begin to see her not only as a person who was very involved with a charismatic, amazing husband, but also a woman who had a long life full of really good work.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher, and you're listening to Pearl Clegg. She is a playwright. She wrote a song for Coretta. It is Ohio State Theater's debut at Kappa's newly restored Lincoln Theater. We invited Pearl to join us today, and we'll be bringing in the director and also the assistant director and choreographer in a few minutes. If you want more information, go to theater.osu.edu for more information about the play. Pearl, how did Coretta Scott King inspire you? So you're watching this on television unfold, and you think of writing the play, but there had to be something deeper on a personal level for you about how she inspired you. Or,
well, I actually knew her. My first job when I came to Atlanta was at the very new Martin Luther King Center, which became the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolent Social Change. But I came to Atlanta in 1969, not long after Dr. King was assassinated, and Mrs. King was putting together a library documentation project to collect materials and organize materials about the civil rights movement. And that was actually my first job in Atlanta, was going to people's houses and asking them if we could have the boxes of materials that they would have in the basement or in the attic. But, you know, things that actually documented all of the amazing change that happened in this region, in Georgia, just in the very recent past. And Mrs. King was the driving force behind that institution. So I had an opportunity to work with her, and then had a chance to work with her at various other times on committees and things while I was in Atlanta. And most recently, I guess, saw her at Oprah Winfrey's Legends Weekend, where she was one of the 25 African-American women who were honored by that weekend.
So you probably, I guess, identified more with Helen, the elder woman of the group, only 57, though, I might add, which I think is almost spring chicken-like. So I don't want to, you know, miscast that. But
absolutely, but she would definitely be the voice of my generation. I mean, I'm a 60s child.
And the generation gap in terms of the African-American community was a big theme.
Well, I think it's true of the American community.
Yes.
I think that American communities across the board have tremendous generational problems. And, you know, we tend to focus on the technology as the difference between one generation and the other. But I think there are tremendous differences in terms of what people think is important, what people think is the meaning of life, what people are really moved by to do certain things for other people. And I think that's part of what the play is about, something that that isn't specific to the African-American community, mm-hmm. but certainly in the play, you know, where you've got a very young person who is obviously not what the older character, what Helen would have thought she was sitting in for and fighting for and all of that. And I hear a lot from older people, you know, a real disconnectedness from younger people. In all kinds of ways.
And yet, Keisha, the 17-year-old, 16 or 17-year-old, the teenager, she's pregnant. She was there. There was something she couldn't quite put her finger on, but there was a reason why she had to be there. She knew it was the right thing to do, but she couldn't have even told you the refrain from, you know, "We shall overcome."
Exactly. And that's something that I think is part of what I was trying to look at, just the power of someone who you may never have met, who you may never know, but in some way touches your life. I mean, this girl was, you know, not a person who would be a movement person at all, but she was touched by the reporting of the life of Mrs. King. So she didn't even really encounter Mrs. King in any real way emotionally until after Mrs. King had died. So that it was interesting to me that there were several, you know, references in the play to the girl who had a friend who was praying to the Virgin of Guadalupe, and people were praying to different entities trying to make sense of the world. And I think that's what that young character is trying to do, because everybody that she looks at isn't making any sense at all. So she's hoping maybe the spirit of Coretta King can help her make sense of a very complicated world.
You know, another thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, obviously, but my impression was that all of the characters were there on the quote-unquote spur of the moment.
Exactly. Exactly, because they had been moved in the same way that I was, you know, moved to say, wow, this is an amazing moment. Now, I'm a writer, so I went immediately to my desk and started writing, as opposed to going to get my umbrella to stand in line. But it's the same impetus where you really feel something that you hadn't expected to. And I think there's so many different things going on all the time that people rarely have meaningful exchanges with people who are very, very different than they are. And that's one of the things I wanted to have happen in this line. I wanted all of these women to have different reasons for being there, and also to come from very different places, you know, being a soldier in Iraq.
Yeah.
survivor of Katrina, and being a young girl, you know, trying to make sense of having a baby, and being an older woman saying, is this all there is? But just to really let them, during that one brief moment that they're in line together, become a community.
The impression it left with me is sort of different varying degrees of having a foothold. Helen Richards, the older woman, she seemed to have the strongest foothold because she remembered, and she had met Coretta Scott King, the reporter, the young reporter, does a great job with the part, was looking for a career foothold. The artist had lost her anchor in the world, a very sad story there, and the pregnant teenager was kind of trying to learn to be an anchor, and the soldier thought she had won a foothold, but then she lost it.
I think that's very true, that they're all looking for something that's not going to keep moving. You know, people think they believe one thing and then it changes.
Yeah.
Think they believe something else and it changes. And I think that many people, especially as fast as the world is moving, many people are looking for something that is unchangeable. And I think, you know, people find that in God. They find that in all kinds of things. But I think that that's part of what we're made to feel when we look at all these women, is that they are women coming from, many of them, from very severe circumstances. You know, and the thing that they're hoping will help them is, you know, being in the presence of someone whose life was deeply rooted in another era altogether, which is why Helen seems to be a more grounded person, because she came of age in a time when community really meant something serious and tangible, and where there were movements that shaped her movement through the world, as opposed to now, which is what we see in the very young character in this book, is mm-hmm. out there by herself trying to figure out, you know, what to do. There is no movement. There is no community that supports her in the way that when Helen is talking about the Montgomery bus boycott, you can imagine what that community was like, that those people walked for a whole year and helped each other get wherever they needed to go because they were a community. That kind of thing doesn't exist nearly as much, I think, as it used to.
And yet they argued, and Keisha along with them, about whose story was more important.
Exactly.
They were defensive about, well, maybe you were there and you know that, but I matter too.
Right. And my story is different, and you can't judge my story by what was the standard in 1954, because this is 2010. You know, my world is different. My understanding of myself is different. You know, all the good things have happened and all the bad things have happened. But you can't look at me and say, why can't you be more like we were? You know, because that's always a big part of the generational rift, you know, is the older people saying, why can't you be like we were? I mean, I was watching West Side Story the other night, and there's a scene where people keep telling the guy, when I was your age, mm-hmm. when I was your age, and the kid, who's a teenager, says, you were never my age.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We were always different, you know, because we're young. And I think part of that is what Helen has to deal with, the older character,
right.
is, you know, just to say, wow, this girl's life is very different, and this soldier's life is very different. And, you know, how do we begin to talk across all those lines?
We have to take a quick break right now. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Pearl Clegg. She's playwright of A Song for Coretta. It is Ohio State Theater's debut in Kappa's newly restored Lincoln Theater. I was there last night. It was lovely. We invited Pearl to join us today. We're going to joining the conversation after the break, Leslie Ferris, director of the OSU production, and also assistant director and choreographer Mopi Matabedi. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
And good morning. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. At noon, fresh air will be here. In 2007, Charlie Company faced insurgents in one of the worst neighborhoods in Baghdad and lost more men than any other battalion since Vietnam. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Kelly Kennedy tells their story. That discussion and much more on Fresh Air at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 32 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 38. Clear skies tonight and a low right around 20 degrees. Sunshine for Friday and a high of 38.
Support for WOSU comes from Ohio Wesleyan University, congratulating its students on receiving the Presidential Award for Higher Education Community Service. Last year, nearly 1,800 Ohio Wesleyan students gave their time and talent to help others. OWU.edu.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Ain't gonna let nobody love tear me right, tear me right.
That is Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Round, being sung by the SNCC Freedom Singers, led by Cordell Reagan, at a local church meeting. It is the introductory song to the play A Song for Coretta by playwright Pearl Clegg. Pearl's with us on the phone right now. Thanks again for being with us, Pearl.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And my other guest, Leslie Ferris, director of the Ohio State Theater's debut in Kappa's newly restored Lincoln Theater, A Song for Coretta. Leslie is in the studio with us today. Leslie, thanks for joining us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
And also Mopi Mutabelli, he is assistant director and choreographer for the production. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Pearl, I didn't know it, but Leslie and Mopi are very excited to hear your voice.
Oh, I'm glad to have a chance to say thanks for doing my show.
Well, it's been a great pleasure.
Let's talk about that song because, Mopi, that was the introduction to the play, and is that part of the play?
It's not in the script.
Okay.
We did some pre-show music, and then we used that one. That was the final piece of kind of pre-show music, and we really saw that as beginning the show, and an opportunity to introduce the characters and some of the ideas that are throughout the whole production.
Why that song?
Well, we discovered it. Actually, Mopi found it. We were doing research. Our production team was doing, and our sound designer was doing research on freedom songs. And, of course, we knew some of the main popular ones, and we wanted to look for other possibilities. And Mopi discovered that. He was listening to a whole bunch of them. You might want to say something,
yeah.
Mopi, about why you
What
you
inspired
thought that
you
was,
about that?
Well, at first, looking at the movement piece that we were integrating into the piece, we saw that this song, will fit perfectly, with that particular movement piece. And especially another thing with the words, what the woman say, what is sung, ain't nothing going to turn me around, because we like to think that this is how this great woman led her life, no matter what happens, nothing's not going to turn me around and I'm going to keep on walking, and we saw that as something very symbolic to this whole piece, and fit in perfectly well with the movement piece
and
as well.
It resonated with me through the play because of their each character's assertion that, no, I am who I am and I'm important and you can't tell me I'm not.
Right.
Yes. Pearl, when you hear interpretations like this, what's it like? Because the play, you wrote it, or it was first produced in 2007, I think.
It's great. It really is. I was actually sitting here thinking to myself, this is why I love theater. The theater is such a collaborative art form, so that, everything they said, I'm thinking here, sitting here thinking, that's right. That's exactly
that's
right.
Wonderful. Yeah.
Because what it does is allow other artists to have a chance to come and have, some artistic part of that collaboration, so that even if it's across the miles, because we're nowhere near close to each other, it can stand to make the piece stronger because there's so many different artistic energies moving around. So it's wonderful for me.
And then, Mopi, you choreographed the movements at the top of the production. Tell us about that.
Yes.
First, why don't you describe it for the listeners who haven't been lucky enough to see it yet?
Okay. Well, you have the woman coming in a procession holding the umbrellas. We use the umbrellas as a kind of symbol, a running motif, and we wanted to integrate that into the movement piece. They come on stage with the umbrellas, we can't see their faces. There's a step, it's a very – the step is quite movement orientated. It's not a dance. It's more
it's
movement.
It's like a march. It's almost it's a march. Almost a dirge like quality to it. They
are,
of course,
embodies
mourning.
The marches, you know. So and that is it's open for interpretation as well, you know, because we looked at it as these women can also be the marches of this time, you know. You know, standing firm, and that whole essence of being proud of who they are, strong black women. And so what happens is that upon research, when I looked at this movement sequence, I wanted something, you know, that will fall into place with the piece and not become a production all on its own. And so looking at the research and looking at the bus boycotts, especially, you know, it was said that the way these Coretta Scott King and the late Mr. King, you know, Dr. King, what happened is that they organized rides. They organized these rides, private rides, you know, instead of taking the buses. And one comment that was said about those rides is that they were led with such military precision, you know. And that is something that we wanted to embody in this movement sequence, along with the umbrellas, as these women passed the umbrellas, you know, between each other. And in that way, we wanted to embody that whole essence of moving about in such a military precision in the movement sequence. And so that is where that whole idea came about, you know, at the beginning of the play, these marches moving about. We're seeing these women standing together in unison and passing these umbrellas.
And you couldn't see the women, the individuals at first. All you could see was their legs. You didn't know who was behind the umbrella, which was interesting because they looked very uniform in that way. And then the umbrellas both, to me, represented a weapon and also an umbrella, a protector, something that protects you.
Right.
When you work together on this, and now, Pearl, when you hear this, can you visualize it?
I'm trying to visualize it. It sounds wonderful. I want to see it.
It's like they march out. It's like a slow march, and then they're using the umbrellas to the beat of the music. They're using they're hitting the floor with them. But when Leslie, when you and Mopey work on something like this, how do you agree that this is going to work for you?
Well, I mean, I discussed the idea at the beginning of the show of having some kind of physical theater moment to get us into the show and kind of unify it. And I think I wanted to use, I mean, you know, being in an educational institution, we like to draw on the strengths of the people we're working with. And I knew Mopey was very good at coming up with interesting ideas that would serve the production. And I know that our students are trained in physical theater. There's a strong component of that. So I thought I just wanted to put them to the test, so to speak, and give them that opportunity. And I think the whole – I mean, the idea of the umbrellas, of course, comes from the script. I mean, Pearl's written it into the script that they're holding umbrellas. And so the umbrella became a kind of visual metaphor in a way. And I should mention, too, that the scenic design also incorporates a whole rows of umbrellas of various sizes to give a sense of the line that is there. So we have the kind of static – umbrellas as part of the scenery, and then you have these kind of mobile umbrellas with the actors.
You know, as they're lined up and they're sort of anonymous looking, Pearl, it kind of probably was what you were looking at the outset when you were watching television that day.
Exactly.
But then your imagination got going and you started to imagine, well, what was really going on down there.
Exactly. And then they become specific. That's
right. Yeah. They're revealed to be the characters. Yeah.
Pearl, when you were watching them on television, watching this line, were there people in that line that actually inspired you that you looked at and said, "Oh, she's this character"?
No, I didn't. I didn't get that specific. Mm-hmm. I looked at the sweep of them, and there were different kinds of people, you know, different ages of people, and all of that. But I wasn't actually trying to find one. Outside of my own imagination, I knew there were a whole bunch of them walking around in there. Once I saw them, it was like, okay, let's just pick five. You know?
Well, if you get five women together anyway, they're all going to have a different story no matter what. But, you know, there's a line in the play that really, really got to me. The black women used to stand for something. And that operated on so many levels because here, of course, they're standing in line and that kind of thing. Can you talk about what you meant by that?
Well, I think that line really embodies the disappointment, the generational disappointment that we were talking about earlier, that this woman is very disappointed in young people generally, and she groups them all together pretty much as young people. But I think that when she's looking then at Gwen, she thinks that Gwen, the soldier, has really done something wonderful, and she can kind of, that can be the one that she says, well, at least there's one who's doing something good. And then when she reveals that she doesn't want to continue to be a soldier, I think that it just is really too much for Helen, you know. So she looks at all of them and is just very disappointed in what they have become, because she's looking for, you know, women who are like her to be the ones who move forward. And she doesn't really have that idea that the next generation is going to look different, they're going to sound different. You know, that's why Gwen's response has to be, well, maybe, you know, this is what my freedom looks like. You know, so you have to adjust, because this is a reality that I'm moving through in my own life.
Mopi, you're from South Africa, and
yes.
I thought of that actually this morning when I was preparing, because you use slides or whatever they call them nowadays.
Yeah.
You
have projections.
Projections, mm-hmm. And one of them is of Coretta Scott King protesting apartheid in South Africa. So it just occurred to me this morning. It's like, well, there's a connection there, tell me about the connection between you and the story, even though you're not from the United States, you're not African American.
Yeah, well. Well, I saw the slide as well upon research that Coretta Scott King in 1985, she stood outside the South African Embassy in Washington.
Only 1985.
1985.
Wow.
Yes, opposing apartheid in South Africa. And she was arrested along with three of her children. And almost a decade later, she would be standing side to side with Nelson Mandela at the presidential inauguration when the country was liberated, you know. And I just found that it was very fascinating for me to become a part of this production, because prior to this production, I'd worked in another production back home, you know, which was a commemoration of a freedom fighter, you know. And I found that, you know, it is a parallel of that. You know, this we were engaged in the same dialogue back home, this generational differences between the people who fought, you know, and who laid down their lives for the liberation of a country. And then they come across the younger generation who seem not to be taking notice of the hard work and of the labor that these men and women, you know, are put into the liberation of a country. And then when I come over here and I'm a part of this production, I'm like, my goodness, this is amazing stuff. You know, I'm just blown away to see the parallels, you know, how strong these parallels are, you know, and I find that really fascinating.
I think that's one of the things that that is so interesting about what cultural work will do, because you realize there's only four or five stories that everybody tells every in the world. We all tell each other the same family stories. We tell each other the same stories about war and about loss and about love. And it's so wonderful when you have a chance to really realize it. I mean, I loved hearing you say that, because I do think that the key to all of us surviving into this next phase is to stop breaking ourselves off into this country or that race or that tribe or this group, and just realize that all these stories are human stories. So that if it takes place in the African-American community, it's probably taking place in the Native American community. If it's taking place there, it's taking place somewhere else. So that once we all get past the fact that all of our stories are so different and realize that they're really the same. You know, these characters are looking at issues that affect all of us, you know, teenage pregnancy, a war, the aftermath of Katrina and all that that meant, finding your place in the world, getting older. All of those stories are stories that human beings work with, so that it's wonderful to hear testament to what I believe to be true, you know, which is we are all telling the same stories and trying to get to the same truth of it.
You know, you did bring in other people from other conflicts, Katrina, the war in Iraq, a teenage girl who's pregnant, a conflict in and of itself. How did you do that? How did you decide which conflicts?
Well, I just tried to look around at all the stuff that's driving me crazy.
So it really is all about venting, right?
Like the start, you know, where you say, okay, what am I really just confused about and angry about and disappointed about and sad about and all of those things? What is it that I see? I mean, I write at home and I look out at my neighborhood as it walks by, and, you know, that character, the little teenage mother, I mean, I see her every day. I hear her mouth every day at the bus stop.
Mm-hmm.
you know, people have said to me, wow, I didn't know you knew that kind of language. I said, get out of here. I live in the world. You know, I listen to people. That's my job, is to make their lives come forward in a way where you can say, oh, my God, that sounds just like those little wild girls walking past my
house. Oh, boy, did she.
Exactly. And it's important for us to be able to hear her, I think, those of us who are not of her set. It's important for us to be able to hear her in a setting where it's certainly safe for us to hear it, but also where we can't leave. Because when we hear that mouth start talking, we of my generation want to get as far away from that as we can. We can't do it. We can't afford to do that. We have to be able to find a space like theater is, where you have to be open to whatever the truth is. And that poor little child in the play, I mean, Keisha's definitely trying to get to the truth all the time. She just has no way of knowing. You know, Lisa tossed her about her grandmother. You know, you got to have one person you can ask.
Right.
You know, is going to tell you the truth. And she lists the people that are in her life that she could ask. And it's like, oh, my God, don't ask them. Please don't ask the drug dealer. Please don't ask the girl who threw the baby doll across the room. Please don't ask. You know, so who's she going to ask? She has to ask us.
Yeah, Keisha and the reporter, is that
Zora?
Zora were an interesting parallel, too. They're both looking for the truth.
Right.
They're both young.
Same generation. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, Dora's just a little older, but her life could be more different because she remembers doing that exercise where you carry the baby doll and it's not supposed to cry and all of that. But their responses to that moment, you know, that high school moment, were so different because one was on her way to Spelman College and one was already pregnant with her second child.
I think I had to say, and I was talking about this earlier, Keisha was probably my favorite character, and maybe it's because I learned the most from her.
Oh, that's great. That's good because she's hard to like.
So yeah.
She's the one that you have to work as a playwright. I have to work hard with her to make you like her because it's she's the one where you want to cover your ears and run out of the theater. I have to make you like her enough to say, oh, you know, and listen to what she has to say and see her as a specific human being rather than as just one more problem child.
And you know, really, of all the characters, they all unfolded. Very interestingly throughout the play. And Keisha was just, you know, sort of like at some kind of gut level, my emotional favorite, but every one of them, it was interesting to see them unfold and open up and that sort of thing. We have to take a quick break right now. Our guests are Pearl Clegg. She is the playwright. She wrote A Song for Coretta. It is Ohio State Theater's production at the Lincoln Theater right now. It opens up tomorrow night through Sunday. Also with me, director Leslie Ferris from Ohio State and assistant director and choreographer Moby Motabeli. He is here from South Africa. He's a graduate student from South Africa. And we welcome everybody to the show. If you have any questions or comments for any of the guests, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
The next Fresh Air, the story of a platoon in Iraq that had so many losses. The men were so angry and stressed they felt they needed a break or else they would end up hurting civilians. They refused to follow orders and go back in the field. We talk with journalist Kelly Kennedy, who was embedded with the platoon and has written a new book about it. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. WOSU Public Media and J.P. Morgan Chase present Columbus Neighborhood Share Your Story Day this Saturday, March 6th, from 4 until 6 p.m. at the Sherry Gallery in the Short North. WOSU is collecting your photos and treasured memories of life in Columbus's Short North District for an online community project and TV documentary. Call 292-9678 to participate or visit WOSU.org for more information. And tune in for a special All Sides with Ann Fisher on Monday, March 8th at 10 a.m. The program will be broadcast from Cup of Joe in the Short North and will preview WOSU's television documentary, Columbus Neighborhoods. The first of six shows debuts Monday night at 8 on WOSU-TV and shows the history of the revitalized Short North neighborhood. But you can learn more about this project and get a preview of the documentary on All Sides with Ann Fisher Monday at 10 on WOSU 820 NPR News. And the program continues. Thanks for joining us for All Sides with Ann Fisher.
that is, of course, This Little Light of Mine. It was led by Betty Mae Fikes at a church meeting. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. Welcome back to the program. My guest, Pearl Clegg, playwright. She wrote a song for Coretta, and it is Ohio State Theater's debut in Kappa's newly restored Lincoln Theater. It is showing beginning tomorrow through Sunday. So if you want more information on that, go to theater.osu.edu, or you can go to wosu.org/allsides for a link to that. Pearl, also joining me in the studio, by the way, director Leslie Ferris and assistant director and choreographer Moby Motabelli. Pearl, why that song?
Oh, I love that song.
I do too.
It's a great song, and it's one of those songs that everybody can sing. Even if you don't know the song, if you hear just the first part of it, because the words are pretty much the same over and over and over. There are verses, but people almost never sing the verses. They just chorus over and over and over. So it's a wonderful song to get people moving, to get people on their feet. It's optimistic, and it takes it puts forward individual responsibility. I'm going to do this. I'm going to make myself be the best person I could be, the best warrior I can be, nonviolent demonstrator I can be. So it's a song that always has moved every crowd I've ever seen sing it. People leap to their feet and, you know, clap their hands and sing it to the end.
It's inspired, or you come to the song through the story by way of Keisha, who is looking for a lullaby or something to sing to her baby when her baby is born.
Mm-hmm. And she really doesn't know any movement songs at all. So that they get into a discussion, which I just liked as a playwright, just about the idea that these are not lullabies. These are supposed to be songs that inspire you and make you, you know, get up and do something, not songs that put you to sleep. But the other reason for This Little Light of Mine for me is that's a song that Fannie Lou Hamer used to sing in mass meetings. And Fannie Lou Hamer was a wonderful activist from Mississippi, one of the founders of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. Just a wonderfully brave, very influential woman who inspired so many people. And she would sing this song, and she had a very powerful, deep voice, and she would begin to sing this song, and it would be a moment of actual danger for people, you know, where it was really life and death, and they would, by the end of the song, they'd be ready to march out into the Mississippi night and do what had to be done.
And two, it doesn't date you. You can sing it for any time. It doesn't have a date to it.
Exactly. And it doesn't have a specific problem area.
Yeah.
You are so bad, we're going to beat you down. It doesn't say, you know, we are on one side and you were on the other. It says, you know, all of us, if all of us can just deal with our own little light shining, do you know, think how wonderful that would be.
Leslie Ferris, the play has been touring Central Ohio high schools,
yes,
right,
yeah.
Since early February. Now, you weren't able to bring the whole production there because of technical,
yes.
For technical reasons, but what's it been like, and what sort of response have you been getting from high school students?
Well, I went to see the last tour we did last week. Mopey's been at every one of them. And they've
so Mopey, you know, chime in.
Right. They've been very positive and enthusiastic. And in the one that I saw, everyone started clapping at the end with that song and joined in singing and standing. And we always, when we take it into schools, we usually have a question and answer period afterwards, and there were a lot of questions. In fact, we had to cut it off. And a lot of the
that's a good feeling.
Yeah, a lot of the students who were asking,
great thing.
Yeah, fantastic. And they were asking questions about the characters, and not like, why do you want to be an actor, but, you know,
yeah,
things about the piece. And I think that's a real tribute to the piece, that people want to ask about that.
You know, Pearl, don't you find that kids know more today than they did 20 years ago? I do, because they weren't teaching us much in high school.
I wouldn't say that. I think they knew different kinds of things.
Okay.
That, of course, we couldn't know because they didn't exist. But I don't. I think that I wouldn't say that. I think the kids that I knew and the kid that I was, I think we were very thoughtful. I think we were concerned about things. We had, like, a war to deal with because the war in Vietnam was drafting people our age. We had the changes that were going on because of the civil rights movement to deal with. And I was living in Detroit, so we had the absolute roaring beauty of Motown to deal with. So it was like, I think we were very thoughtful as a generation of people. But I think every generation is thoughtful. I think it expresses itself in very different ways. And that part of the gulf between current children and us as children is that we don't know how to communicate through the ways that are important to them. You know, my grandchildren are 6 years old and 8 years old, and they already know how to text and tweet and all of that, and I don't know any of that. So that whole part of their brain is not accessible to me because I don't think that way. So I have to, you know, because I'm the grandmother, exercise authority and say, no, we will communicate face to face. You must talk to your grandmother, and they're fine with it. But they have a whole other range of things that are different. But I don't think it makes them necessarily smarter. I think it makes them different.
You know, the Obamas, to celebrate, one of the things they did to celebrate Black History Month was to have the Freedom Song. I can't remember exactly what the name of the program was, but at the White House, they...
I saw that. Mm-hmm. With Bernice Johnson Reagan was on there and Smokey Robinson was
right
on there. Yeah.
That must have been kind of great. I mean, that was sort of what you were getting at.
I thought it was lovely. I thought the mixture of people was really important because they, you know, sometimes when you look at it, you separate out the politics of people's lives from the other cultural expressions that are going on in their lives. And I thought that program did a really excellent job at mixing the artists so that you get the feeling that everyone is affected by the big social movements, you know, that flow through their generation and flow through our time. And I think that that's one of the things that the music that comes forward is always able to do, that a lot of the songs that were on the radio reflected the freedom songs that we were singing in marches and demonstrations. It was expressed in a different way, but that energy for change and a positive, upbeat, kind of hopeful idea about what America could be was in the music the same way it was in the demonstration.
Leslie, did
you
see
that? Yeah. No, unfortunately, I didn't. I'd heard of it. I've heard about it, but I unfortunately didn't get to see it.
And a big component of that was bringing high school kids in and bringing younger people in to learn that. And it made me think of that last night when I was watching it. Music is kind of universal. I was wondering, Mopi, if the music that the freedom music from the United States, if you ever heard of it before you came here.
Yeah, obviously through what...
So you say obviously, but I...
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of American content that we get back home in televisions and...
Just in general.
In general, okay. You know, so I would come across a lot of it, you know. Yeah, the freedom songs that, you know, were sung during, those times, you know. So I was aware of some of them.
So at the end, how do you work on the choreography at the end? Why don't you describe what you did?
That is the where the play takes on the climatic arrangement where we have the double speech between Gwen and Mona Lisa. It is a very, very delicate moment in the play because they reveal their struggles, what they personally went through. And what we wanted to do with that one was have the woman act as a chorus where they embody and exemplify and enact out the story that is being told between these two ladies, you know, just to make it more powerful, to strengthen it visually and as well through what the woman is saying, you know. So that was the whole notion, that was the whole idea behind that moment.
Yeah, and I think the idea of using the kind of idea of a chorus, a Greek chorus perhaps, mm-hmm. where you know, in the original Greek choruses 2,500 years ago, they were composed of citizens. They in fact, you had to do as a kind of rite of passage for the male citizens to be in a Greek chorus. And so, in a way, I felt they were both witnesses as citizens in this piece at the end of the play, and also commentators on it as well. So these kind of silent witnesses that stood behind the two women with their double monologues, which is how we refer to them at times in the rehearsal process.
You know, in that those revelations, Pearl, I thought of all the secrets we keep from each other and how that weakens us.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what that's about. That's why when Mona Lisa says, you know, I'll say it if you say it with me, all of that is because the truth of our existence, the things that are really important to us, are right below the surface. But we spend a lot of time trying to keep from saying what's really on our hearts, what we really are thinking and feeling, because it's frightening to expose yourself in that way. And I think that part of what Mona Lisa is trying to say to Gwen is it's worse to keep it in, that you always find that someone else can share the pain that you feel has gone through, the struggles that you've gone through, but you've got to tell us what you're feeling. So hopefully that's what that moment kind of allows them to see the truth of each other's lives that are right there, but they wouldn't come up in conversation unless somebody pushed it.
You know, Helen the Elder is the apparent wise person, but really Mona Lisa, the artist, brings it all together.
Exactly. So that's just a little lobbying for the artist as being the real power.
Yes.
Plus, she's from New Orleans, and people from New Orleans have a magic that is just comes from being from New Orleans. So I wanted her to kind of be one who could see deeper into human beings, because more spirits walking around in New Orleans than any place I've been in the United States.
And
yeah. I want her to have that.
And I love New Orleans. I love it. I went there twice in one summer a few years ago. So Katrina as well, incredible spirit of regeneration.
And that's why I think that character is important too, because she gets to remind us that New Orleans still has to heal from all that, that people have still been horribly injured psychically and every other kind of way by what happened there, and to not forget that that's part of what we need to be working with as a country. You know, how do we repair that moment for those people?
I think the idea of also paralleling that with the soldier's story, this notion of psychic healing, was such an imaginative leap to make. I mean, to make those two stories be simultaneous, because one is in our own continent, and the other isn't. And I think that even just thinking the geographic distance, we automatically think, well, no, those aren't connected. But wait a minute, there's something that does connect them.
Well, and the parallels of the shame of not being able to help. Being able to help someone who was weaker than you.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And that you see something that you know is so terribly wrong, and you feel absolutely powerless to do anything about it.
Yeah.
Which takes all your hopefulness away, because you feel like if this is what human beings are really like, then what's the point of anything? And that's really why they have to, although it's a hard thing to think, this is our future, they've got to invest in teaching Keisha some freedom songs. You know, she's having a child. That kid is going to be the one who has to grow up and see things more clearly and think more deeply and be more peaceful and all of that, so that it's like the world that baby is coming into is the world that's, making Gwen be afraid and making Mona Lisa be homeless and all the rest of it. So there's hopefully lots of layers between these women that make us all think about what we're doing and who the women are that we know and who the women are that we see, and think about how connected we are down so many levels.
The harmony at the end is so important. Is that ultimately the song for Coretta?
Yeah, I think so. All of us singing together in peace, I absolutely think so.
There was something that Mona Lisa, the artist, mentioned at the beginning, that she, Coretta Scott King, had a way about her of just getting back to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell me about that. Why is that a valuable?
Well, I think that there's always a tendency when something terrible happens to you to just fall out. Like, this is the worst thing that ever happened to anyone who ever lived on this earth, and I can't possibly go on. And I think that one of the things that we really admire in Coretta King was the fact that she was a young mother with young children, and her husband was brutally assassinated as he was trying to make his country a better place. And I think she could have just become bereft and just not been able to go on, and all of us would have understood that, but she didn't. She chose to get back up and go right back to the movement and her work and participate in a demonstration, a few days after, and to continue throughout her life to do his work. And I think that's, why we realized that it wasn't just his work. It was also her work, the work of all of those people who came together to make that boycott and to make those demonstrations and to make the movement move the country ultimately in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mopi, about the harmony, how do you tell me a little bit more about how that is manifested in the choreography at the end, and how you move the people together at the end. They were swaying, sort of buffeted by the times that they went through, visually at least. That's what it looked like to me. They're all they're all moving together.
Moving together. Yes, that's It's a very powerful song, that one, This Little Love of Mine. And when the women sing that, we try to let them know that, what does this mean? What does this song personally mean to you as a character in this play? Let it touch you first. And then when that happens, that's when you'll reach out to the audience and they will become a part of it, and that's when they'll join in. That's when you'll see that sway that they'll have, at towards the end, and that's the idea that we went about, with that particular song. Let it touch you first, And then, you know, that energy that will automatically transcend itself into the auditorium, into the energy, into the audience, you know. Yeah.
And that's what happened in the high schools when they join in and start clapping. And, of course, in those situations, we're not – we do have our sound effects when we go into the high school, but we don't have any special lights and we can't project anything. So it's a – you know, the lights are fully up, you know, the audience are right. not sitting in the dark. So so it's quite extraordinary that it still works. It still works. That music gets it there.
And we didn't necessarily give the actors the direction, you need to sway here. It's just something that automatically came through the song, them enjoying it, you know. And then all of a sudden we saw them started swaying from one side to the other and we're like, oh, this works well. So we're going to keep that in.
Yeah, they were like a wave in the ocean or something. Yeah, it was very organic. And, you know, that's the problem. Seeing it last night, of course, was a dress rehearsal. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the benefit of seeing it with the whole audience. And Pearl, you said that it's kind of bringing out that reaction in audiences all over the place.
Yeah, that people really, and if at the, by the end, they want to sing something. They want to be a part of it. So that it's really wonderful to hear that that's what's happening in the high schools. There's a wonderful moment in the movie of Woodstock where Sly and the Family Stone are singing, and he's saying, okay, I want y'all to sing along. And he says, a lot of people don't want to do it, but if it was good then, it's still good. About that song, it was always good, and it's still good.
In the play, there's a great part for me where Zora is singing along with Helen, We Shall Overcome, and it reminded me of being in church. These people that kind of word the you know, mouth the songs, they don't really say it. And Helen was trying to sing, and she's not a great singer, but Zora was hilarious. I mean, it was a very funny moment for me.
I wish I could see the show. It sounds wonderful.
I enjoyed it very much. Pearl Clegg, playwright, author of A Song for Coretta, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me. I had a great time.
Appreciate it. And also Leslie Ferris, Ohio State University, your director of the production. It is at the Lincoln Theater this weekend.
Yes.
You can go to WOSU.org for more information. But Leslie, thanks for joining us as well.
Yes, thank you. It was delightful.
Appreciate it. And Moby Motobelli, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very
much. Choreographer and assistant director for A Song for Coretta this week. Before I go, I want to tell you that All Sides with Ann Fisher is going to be broadcast live from the Short North at the Cup of Joe on the Cap, 600 North High Street, next Monday, March 8th. It is my first live remote. Listeners are welcome to join the audience or tune in for this special All Sides. It will preview WOSU's television documentary about the revitalized Short North neighborhood. And that debuts at 8 p.m. on Monday night on WOSU-TV. For more information, go to our website at WOSU.org. For more information about the show, go to WOSU.org/allsides. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus. And streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from SAFI, Specialized Alternatives for Families and Youth, envisioning the day when every child is part of a loving family and is able to reach his or her greatest potential. Information is online at safy.org.